gauging whether you might drink too much. You don't have to be an alcoholic to be a problem drinker. In fact, new research shows a rise in the past decade in the number of people who might have a drinking problem. An extensive survey done by the National Institutes of Health last year found nearly one-third of all adults in the U.S. will have alcohol abuse disorder at some point in their lives, and very few will seek treatment. Alcohol abuse disorder, or AUD, is the medical diagnosis for drinking that can cause distress or harm. Most people with AUD, or who binge drink, do not fit the definition of an alcoholic. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss the study with the director of the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcoholism, and with blogger Alex Steed, who has chronicled his own experience with not drinking for more than a year. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For many of us, having a drink or two at night isn't that big of a deal. But what if that drink turns into three or four? Does that mean we have a problem with alcohol? How do we know? Today, we're going to learn about alcohol abuse disorder, which is the medical diagnosis for problem drinking, from the director of the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcoholism. Dr. George Kube will be joining us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. In the studio with me right now, Alex Steed. He's founding partner of the content firm Knack Factory and is a blogger for the Bangor Daily News. He has written about his decision a couple years ago to stop drinking completely, and today he has a blog out about his decision to begin drinking in moderation again today. I want to thank you, Alex, for being here, and hopefully we'll be hearing from Dr. Kube in just a minute. So, Alex, and I also want to give out our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Of course, you can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Alex, you write about many things on your blog, but yes, your columns about your relationship with alcohol seem to have really struck a nerve. They've had a huge response. Walk us through your story. Why did you decide to quit drinking a couple of years ago?
Sure. Well, I was in my late 20s. No, that's not true. Sorry. I was 30, and I just hit 30. I am married and I have a daughter, and realized at some point that I was drinking more than I liked to be drinking. Part of my job and my work and my life and being a writer and part of all that is socializing, and a lot of that socializing, especially in this town, is alcohol centered. And I realized that I was having trouble. I was having trouble with the amount that I was drinking. I was having trouble if I decided that I didn't want to drink anymore. Stopping drinking. It was sort of always around, and I finally decided, like, I need to stop and figure this out. Like, why is this happening for me personally? What can I do to stop it? I needed to stop in order to take a step back and look at myself and figure out why this was happening.
At that time, do you feel like you were drinking about on par with many other people in your professional social circle? I mean, this is the group of young professionals who goes out after work.
Sure.
And has a few drinks.
I think I was drinking around that much and probably a little bit more. Like, I wasn't, I've heard stories of people who, carry with them nips and drink, sort of have to drink throughout the day in order to get by. It was not sort of at that place, but it was definitely at a place where on more than one occasion, I realized in retrospect that I was ignorant to my state as a means of being able to drive myself home and felt regret about doing that. Realizing that I was doing things or acting in ways that if I weren't drinking, I would have felt guilty or irresponsible for those things.
Was it hard to not drink?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's not hard to not drink. It's not hard to abstain from something for the sake of abstaining from it. What was hard was sort of completely reconfiguring how I lived my life. What was hard was finding new relationships with clients that didn't involve alcohol. What was hard was, not having a glass of wine with my wife at the end of the day. And then what was especially difficult was sort of the soul searching piece of looking at, what am I, what am I using alcohol to either avoid or remedy or you know, to blur me to reality? Why am I doing that? You know, it wasn't for me just a matter of stopping. It was a matter of figuring out why this thing was happening. And that, yeah, it was very difficult.
You'd write, though, that you had a lot of positive benefits. Mm. Tell me how your life is different now that you're sort of, where are we, almost 2 years into this journey?
Yeah. So it's the positive benefits sort of on the abstract are just, you know, like I said, you know, I know I'm not alone in people who've had a couple of drinks, went home, and just because they weren't, you know, blackout drunk doesn't mean that they should have driven. I'm certainly a person who has done that in the past, and just being happy that that is not sort of a thing that enters even my consciousness anymore. That's a huge piece from sort of a moral perspective. The other superficial pieces are I lost 50 pounds when I stopped drinking for a number of reasons. One, when I start drinking, I gain an appetite and then eat and drink. And also excess drinking leads to me not going to the gym in the morning. Like there are pieces where I lost a good deal of weight, and that was made me feel much healthier. And then the last piece was drinking is very expensive when you add up the receipts at the end of the year. And, you know, in the first full year, I literally saved thousands of dollars on money that wasn't going towards booze.
And in today's column, you write that you've decided mm-hmm. to drink again.
Right.
In a very different way than you drank before.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the problem that I see face a lot of people who want to stop drinking is that they like drinking. Which is to say, like, they like nice wine, or they enjoy, we live in a state that produces really amazing beers everywhere. There's a craft to it, sort of, it's a piece of culinary culture. And there are people who both have a problem with drinking, but also enjoy it. And I'm one of those people. So I decided that, I haven't worked through everything. It's a process. It's sort of a long going process. And there's stuff I still need to work out in order to understand my relationship with alcohol. But I will be drinking, at least in the immediate term, in moderation.
And you wrote in your column today, mm-hmm. that's just out today, and we've posted that on the MPBN Main Calling Facebook page, that in the last 10 weeks, you've had 10 drinks.
Right.
Which is something you might have had in one night before.
Yeah, absolutely. And these are things I really want to emphasize the caveat that this is very specifically my experience. And I know we're not saying it's not. But I worry when talking publicly about what I am or am not doing by way of drinking that I'm setting an example for other people. And I hope that people don't take it that way. I think the takeaway from my experience is, do you feel like you have control over your decisions? And if you don't, maybe rethink what you're doing. So sort of that's my take on this. But yes, in my most recent experience, moderation has been the key, and it's been the focus. And it's something that I hope to keep focusing on. And if I feel like it gets out of control, I will need to re-examine my relationship with alcohol.
I understand we now have Dr. George Kube with us. Dr. Kube, we're really honored to have you with us on Main Calling today.
Hi, good to be with you.
You know, Dr. Kube, the organization you lead, the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcohol Abuse, last year released the results of a large study which showed that about 1 in 3 adults will have something called alcohol abuse disorder at some point in their life. What is alcohol abuse disorder, and why is it a concern?
It's alcohol use disorder, and the reason it's a concern is that it causes about $225 billion worth of cost to our society, not to mention all the medical costs and social costs and work productivity costs that go into alcohol use disorder. Alcohol use disorder is a catch-all term for having a problem with alcohol. It can range from your interviewer's issues that he had all the way up to what I would call the terminal alcoholic, who is the classic alcoholic that you see in movies and plays, who really can't function at all and ends up in many cases killing themselves through some secondary effect like pancreatitis or liver cirrhosis.
Your study shows that the numbers are up. Do we understand why there are more people characterized as having alcohol abuse disorder than even a decade ago?
Well, I think that the issue with alcohol is that Americans just don't know much about alcohol. And I've been at this job for 2 years, and I think the most striking phenomenon that I've observed since taking the job as director is that I realize how little people know about alcohol. So while 70% of Americans drink, and most of them drink in a moderate way and enjoy drinking, there's a real huge gap in understanding what alcohol does to the body and how it affects you. And so I always push this whenever I talk about issues, but we do have a website. It's called Rethinking Drinking. And on the website, you can do all kinds of things. You can figure out how much alcohol is in your favorite drink. You can find out how many drinks produce intoxication. You can find out how many drinks will put you at the legal limit. You can find out how many calories are in alcohol. A lot of good information on there.
I understand that your life's work before taking over as the director of the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcohol Abuse is alcohol and other drugs effect on your brain. What can you tell us? What do you want the general public to understand about what alcohol does to one's brain?
Well, it's not good, all right, in simple words. So alcohol use disorders leads to changes in the brain that cause people to drink more to fix the problems that the alcohol did to their brain. And so it really revolves around three issues. Ultimately, you start losing function in your reward system, your pleasure system. You gain a lot of activity in your brain stress system. And even as your interviewer talked about, you lose the ability to make decisions, to make appropriate decisions, and that we call executive function. So it's a triple whammy. You don't feel as good as you used to. You're stressed, and your brain decision-making process doesn't work very well, so you take impulsive and bad decisions.
Does this start after just one drink, or is there sort of a threshold?
Well, there's a great deal of individual differences, so we really need to emphasize that. But normally, there is a threshold. Anything past what we consider moderate drinking, which is 14 drinks a week for a male, 7 drinks a week for a female, more than 3 drinks a day for a male, more than 2 drinks a day for a female, you start pushing the envelope depending on your genetic makeup, your background, whether whether you were abused as a child, whether you've been, had experience with post-traumatic stress disorder. All of these things factor in, whether your family history is one of alcoholics or alcoholism or alcohol use disorder. All of these things factor into the equation. But in general, you're okay in moderate drinking. In fact, there's a fairly strong argument that low moderate drinking is actually beneficial for heart disease, for diabetes, for stroke. So, it's an interesting J-shaped function. It's often talked about with alcohol. Low doses can actually have some beneficial effects. It's certainly a very popular form of social lubrication. I often say that the Research Society on Alcoholism, which is a meeting of researchers dedicated to understanding, how alcoholism takes place and what the pathophysiology is of alcoholism, they start their meeting with a cocktail party. And so, they only give you 2 tickets, but the whole point is that I think that alcohol has a role in our society, and we tried prohibition. That was a complete and utter disaster. But I think what we really need society to understand is that there's a past a certain point, you can get into trouble with alcohol. You can get into trouble with many things.
Alex, is what Dr. Koob's saying on a research level, can you relate to that on a personal level?
Absolutely. And, the thing that I heard from so many people throughout these various posts is because the idea of the alcoholic has been so defined by both popular culture and sort of recovery culture in a way that characterizes a very specific sort of person or a very specific sort of problem, people who have who definitely have problems with their alcohol intake, but can't picture themselves as that, not a caricature, that's a real thing, but can't picture, put themselves in the shoes of that image of the alcoholic, have a very difficult time finding help in solutions or the first step for dealing with what they're dealing with. And I think that that for me was an issue. You know, in my early 20s or in my late teens, early 20s, when I started drinking, you know, I drink and have a good deal of fun and there'd be an adventure and stuff would happen. And then, you know, I feel like throughout my 20s, I kept chasing that in one way or another by drinking more and more and more, having less and less of a good time. And then at some point you realize that you sort of have an intake problem. But because I never felt like sort of, again, the caricature of what we imagine an alcoholic to be, I think I put off finding help or exploring a new way for a couple of years. And I see people do the same thing.
Dr. Koob, does that sound familiar to you? Is that something that the Institute is working on, capturing those people who may not think of themselves as alcoholics, who may not be, for example, good candidates for Alcoholics Anonymous, but yet should seek some help?
Oh, absolutely. Alcohol use disorders takes on every kind of phenotype you can imagine. There are lots of terms out there. Functional alcoholic was one that's always used. I don't particularly like that term because I really think that when a person reaches that stage, they may look functional, but they're not functional. You know, it's a large spectrum, and that's one of the reasons why the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association has, in effect, you know, made it a continuum of intensity. And so, you know, today, if you meet four to six out of 11 criteria, you're in the moderate to severe range that we probably used to call an alcoholic. Some people don't even like using the word alcoholic. On the other hand, you know, I think that there are words that are just part of our society, and we have to address them, even if they are a little bit pejorative. But I think that the point that you can have trouble with alcohol at pretty much any level is a critical one. And when you reach that level of impairment in social and occupational functioning, that's when you should reevaluate. And one of the things we are doing at the Institute is trying to work up a kind of a matrix flow chart for individuals to help them with these kind of decisions. Where would they go? What kind of a counselor would you seek out? Do you have to go to AA? Absolutely not. Are there different kinds of AA? Absolutely. Are there some that might fit you better? Of course there are. Are there some that are not even with religious undertones? Of course there are. There are 12-step programs in many ways. The gentleman that was talking, I mean, he appeared to use what is a very famous technique in a behavioral treatment for alcoholism. It's basically called motivational enhancement therapy or motivational interviewing. But that's where you evaluate your own goals and you generate the motivation within yourself to make change. And one of the ways therapists do that, he did it himself, which is fantastic. But one of the ways therapists who can help you with that do that is they point out that, you know, if you don't drink, you could save quadrillions of dollars a month, maybe get a better apartment, maybe get a better car, maybe get a better surfboard, whatever it, you know, tickles your fancy. But, you know, I think there alcohol use disorders are a wide spectrum, and many people need help long before they reach the stage of the terminal alcoholic. And by the way, alcohol use disorders affects every level of society. It doesn't matter whether you're purple or orange or green. It doesn't matter whether you make tons of money or not. It doesn't matter whether you're an executive or whether you're running your own business. It affects every facet of our society. And that's another thing I think the American public hasn't really digested yet. How prevalent it is and how pervasive it is.
Well, on that note, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, more of our conversation with Dr. Koob and with Alex Steed and your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do St. Joseph's College Online MBA, emphasizing critical thinking, social responsibility, and leadership. More at sjcmba.com. Finance Authority of Maine. Committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainers' success. FameMaine.com. And Sweetser, helping children, adults, and families address mental health and substance abuse issues since 1828. Learn more at Sweetser.org.
Anglican churches sprang up around the world under the British Empire. Now Anglicans in Africa oppose liberal church views on homosexuality.
The imposition of new approaches to what it is to be human is resented more deeply than it is possible to describe.
The Archbishop of Canterbury facing a worldwide split among Anglican churches later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And join us for All Things Considered this afternoon at 4.
On the next Fresh Air, Elizabeth Strout, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of stories Olive Kitteridge, which was adapted into an HBO miniseries. Strout's new novel, My Name is Lucy Barton, was described in the New York Times Sunday Book Review as articulating the Gordian knot of family, binding together fear and misery, solace and love. Join us.
And tune in for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Alcohol Overuse. With me in our studio, Alex Steed, who's founding partner at the content firm Knack Factory. He also blogs about politics and culture for the Bangor Daily News and has written a series of columns on his own experience with quitting drinking and now starting to drink just a little bit again. On the line with us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C., Dr. George Koob, who's director of the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcoholism. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to the calls, though, Dr. Koob, I want to ask you if there's a difference in terms of the way you look at how alcohol affects the brain and how it affects one's health overall in what kind of alcohol one drinks. Is drinking red wine, better for you than having a cocktail on the rocks or really not? Does it not make that big of a difference? I'm sorry, Dr. Koob, did you hear my question?
I hear you. I hear your question. Can you hear me?
You know what we have?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm sorry. We have a technical issue. Oh, shoot. We lost him. We're going to try to get back to Dr. Koob in just a minute. But first, we'll go to Heath, who is calling from Bangor Public Health and Community Services. Hi, Heath. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to thank the panel real quick for having this discussion and super important. And so Bangor Public Health and Community Services is also an HMP, a Healthy Maine Partnership. And we help Maine individuals and Maine communities support their healthy decisions. So I just wanted to let folks know about one resource that might be useful to them. It's called alcoholscreening.org. It's a really quick little tool. Last time I did it, it took me about 5 minutes tops. And it gives you a little prompt at the end that lets you know if maybe it's time that you might want to think about chatting with a medical provider or a mental health provider. And I was also just wondering if when Dr. Koob's able to get back on, if you might be able to spend a second or two on underage drinking and just the impact that has on the brain and how that might increase the risk of alcoholism. And I can take my response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Heath. So we're going to put that alcoholscreening.org onto the website, as well as the website that Dr. Koob mentioned, which is Rethinking Drinking. We're going to go now to Caribou and Jim. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi. Great subject. I just want a minor correction on a comment that was made a few moments ago. Maybe it was just a slip, but there was a comment made about the religious undertones, if you will, about Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are actually spiritual undertones. There's no religion whatsoever involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. So minor correction, but it's important to people who are fresh into recovery and need to know those things. And then I just have one word of advice for my fellow traveler, my brother Alex. When you play on the tracks, you get hit by the train, Alex, so you be good to yourself and take care.
Thank you so much. Can I add a comment that someone had made on this post that a friend of mine read, who has had issues with addiction in the past, and I thought that this was amazing. He said, "Just be careful. Addictions are tricky little what do you say, are tricky, basically, who sneak around and convince you that they are not the real problem, other things are. They promise that this time it will be different and that this time nothing bad will happen. And he keeps going on about that. And I think that is important. It's important to note that everyone's experience is certainly individualized and different. What's been really important for me over this process is learning from other people's experiences. And so everyone who shared with me their issues with either drinking or addiction or recovery have been extraordinarily important in helping my own self-awareness and moderation.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jim. And we do have Dr. Koob back on the line, and I'm thrilled about that. Dr. Koob, the question I had asked earlier when we lost you is about different kinds of alcohol. There's been a lot, certainly, in the media about the benefits of red wine, how it might help in heart health, for example. Is there a difference from your perspective, from scientist who has done research on the effects of alcohol on the brain, with different kinds of drinking, different kinds of alcohol?
Well, first of all, let me say mea culpa on the religious issue, and it really should be spirituality, and the caller was correct. We know that red wine has both alcohol in it and another compound called resveratrol, which it can have beneficial effects. The question that's still out there scientifically is whether there's enough in red wine to convey those the positive effects. And we do see the positive effects on stroke, on diabetes, and on heart disease where they're published and been documented. We see it with all beverages, so it really has to do more with the alcohol than it does with other compounds. But it's an ongoing debate, and I'm sure if you talk to the wine industry, they'll be a little more positive about their product than somebody else's. But, you know, I mean, I think that we are going to be engaging in a longitudinal study at the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism to chart the health benefits of moderate drinking. And you know, we hope that in a longitudinal prospective study, we'll be able to answer some of these questions.
I'm wondering, in doing research for this program today, I came across a study that suggested that folks who don't drink, say, all week, but then drink a great deal on the weekend, you know, maybe you say that 14, they get all of those 14 drinks per week on the weekend, that may be doing more harm than having a glass or two of alcohol a night. Is that what you find?
Yeah, there's pretty good evidence from preclinical work and even in humans that binge drinking, and that's what you're describing, and taking all your 14 drinks in one evening is not a good idea for your brain. It really starts to trigger many of the processes. Most of us recognize it as a hangover, but in a sense, for me, a hangover is a bit like a mini withdrawal syndrome. And so it starts to trigger these neuroadaptive changes in your brain that can have lasting effects, not to mention what it does to your liver. And so, and again, that depends on your makeup. So if you have hepatitis C, or you have HIV, or you have other challenges to your liver, and you do 14 drinks on the weekend, even though that's within the weekly limit, not a good idea. So I think that moderation means moderation in the classical sense of the word. Binge drinking, we know, is deleterious to your health. We define a binge at NIAAA as 5 drinks in 2 hours for a male, 4 drinks in 2 hours for a female. The basis for that, as you know, is body weight and body water distribution. But what we're finding that's a little bit insidious, you asked originally, why are we seeing these increases in alcohol use disorders? What we're finding is that young people who shouldn't be drinking at all, and then even into the middle age, what I would call, you know, 25 to 30 range, if you want to call that middle age anymore. For me, they're young tykes because I'm much older. But, you know, even in those zones, we're picking up on much more intense drinking when people drink. And I think that's a message that really needs to get out to Americans, is that these excessive amounts of alcohol in the course of an evening, 10, 14 drinks, really not good for your body.
Is there research done on, you know, the effects of, you know, our culture on? Is it because people are feeling more stresses? Even high school kids trying to get into college kids trying to get that first job, young professionals feeling the stress that their job, they may lose their job. Is there a connection with that?
Absolutely, we really think so. I've characterized myself as a darksider when it comes to addiction. So I really think that the stress component is a major part of the addiction process, and particularly relevant for alcoholism. And even Alex talked a little bit about how alcohol could remove some of the stressors. But I think the insidious part about alcohol is when it wears off, is that the stress axis comes back in a rebound.
Yes.
and like a revenge. And so you tend to sensitize your brain stress system in alcoholism, in alcohol use disorders, and it takes a long time for that system to return to normal. It really takes a while to return to homeostasis. And there's a good reason for that. I mean, we're built to have a system that's highly responsive, and when a bear chases us up a tree, it's not a good idea to come right down the tree, is it? Because they're going to just hang out and wait for you. So, you know, our body and brain stress system are built with a long hysteresis, I call it, in activity. And what we forget is that alcohol stimulates that, particularly as the alcohol's intoxicating effects wear off.
I know that there is sort of an existing contention between recovery culture and approaches by way of approaches to cessation based on pharmaceutical use, because in recovery culture, there's a belief and reliance on creating community and sort of therapeutic means and going through a process. And there's a worry that pharmaceutical use might sort of circumvent that process. Dr. Kube, I'm curious to hear what research you're finding by way of these pills that you can take that can stop your appetite and alcohol. I know that the program Radiolab back in December did a really great examination of what exists out there, but I'm curious to find out what you have found.
Well, there are three medications approved by the Food and Drug Administration for treatment of alcoholism. One of them you know is Anabuse, which is basically a pharmacological punishment. So if you drink, you get sick, and it's not a very popular drug, as you could well imagine. The other two drugs are very effective, reasonably effective. They have pretty good effect sizes, and one blocks craving. And you alluded to that. That's a Camprasate or Campral. The other one, naltrexone, blocks the rewarding effects of alcohol, and as such can limit binge drinking and heavy drinking, and seems to also help people who want to cut back or even stop. But I consider these pharmaceuticals at this point, first of all, we can do better. I really think that what we know about the neurobiology will help us address some of the things that have gone away from homeostasis, so to speak, and that's, of course, one of the programs we have at NIAAA is development of more effective medications more directed to very specific people and what perhaps systems have gone wrong. But I want to emphasize, for me, medications are always going to be hamburger helper. I really think it's the behavioral treatments, whether they're self-utilized, whether it involves Alcoholics Anonymous, which I think very highly of, whether it involves cognitive behavioral therapy, which is also very effective for many people. I think these are the key elements that are needed for recovery. And, of course, family therapy and community play a critical role integrated with those therapies. And I think the medications can help you along the way. They can give you a little bit of boost. They can help reset your stress axis, perhaps, reset your reward axis, get you back into a drug-free or alcohol-free situation, so you can utilize the behavioral therapies or the community therapies or the family therapies.
All right. Well, we do need to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Maine law firm of Eaton Peabody. Statewide practice, local service, with offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and Portland. And Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint. Casella, giving resources new life.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Gloria Steinem. An activist, author, and leader of the feminist movement, Steinem has written about her uniquely nomadic lifestyle in her memoir, My Life on the Road. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
And you can tune in for that following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock.
The coming El Nino could bring Southern California the water it needs if we can hang on to it.
When it rains now, that water is largely lost to the LA River. What we're designing these projects to do and what the hope is that that water will be collected here and then returned to the groundwater system.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. That story next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
And join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, trying to determine just how much is too much drinking. With me in our studio, Alex Steed, who is a blogger for the Bangor Daily News, and on the line with us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C., is Dr. George Kube, who is director of the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcoholism. Feel free to join our conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Sarah sends an email. She says, I've noticed if I drink perhaps a bit too many at night, I go to bed and fall asleep very quickly, but then wake up 3 or 4 hours later and can't get back to sleep. Could anybody describe this? Is it a sugar spike or some other physical reaction? I'm sorry, that email's from Todd. Go ahead, Dr. Kube.
You know, that's classic, and it's actually what it is the it's kind of like a withdrawal syndrome. So the alcohol will help you fall asleep, but it's not a good solution for helping you fall asleep, because 3 hours later you wake up. Usually you have to go to the bathroom, number one, and that helps wake you up. But the other thing that wakes you up is that your brain goes into a hyperactive glutamatergic-like state. Glutamate is a neurotransmitter in your brain that activates everything, turns on all neurons, and it's very prevalent in the brain. And so this hyperglutamate state drives the waking up, and then you can't get back to sleep. And so while superficially you think alcohol is a great sleep inducer, it's not. And the interaction with post-traumatic stress disorder is particularly insidious, because, you know, they will use alcohol to dull those, to help sleep, because they have terrible time sleeping. They have terrible nightmares. They have, flashbacks. It's really a devastating disorder. But using alcohol, short term, it might help you fall asleep, but then they wake up also, and everything comes back with a vengeance. So it's kind of a physiological backfire.
We have an email from BJ who writes, I wanted to put in a plug for a resource for people who are negatively affected, sometimes severely, by other people's drinking. And talks about his first Al-Anon meeting. He writes, excessive drinking can make you crazy if you have to live with it every day. There is help for people like us, too, and gives the link, www.maineafg.org. So an advocate of Al-Anon. We're going to go on to a call. Paul in Cumberland. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hello. I guess I'm a unique person in that I have never had any alcohol my entire life from birth. I'm now 50, and I've never smoked, I've never drank, I've never taken any drugs, and I'm a fairly normal person, but I've been an athlete my whole life. And I guess, one of the reasons that I didn't start to drink was just a statement from my father early in teenage life, just saying that it's really not anything that's that helpful. And then as I got through college, which was probably the most difficult part, everybody was constantly trying to get you to drink, and that sort of made me angry, saying that I don't need this, and they sort of riled more and more and more, and it went out throughout life, from weddings to bar mitzvahs to etc. Why don't you drink? And that sort of, I took that sort of push and put it back onto myself to continue not drinking, and I have no plans on drinking until I'm 100. So it's sort of different. I'm also an athlete, and it really never helped me as an athlete. I've been in very high level world championships, etc., and it really wasn't useful in that regard.
There really is a very strong cultural tug, though, toward drinking. Do you feel, Paul, even though you may not be, that you are the exception rather than the rule?
Absolutely. My whole life I've been the designated driver, and I've always felt like I stuck out of the room when I go to parties. I'm the only sober one there. Everybody's acting a little bit peculiar. And, you know, I sort of go along with it. I've learned to cope with it, but I'm definitely the odd person out. And I don't think it's that weird that I don't drink, but society definitely doesn't see it as a normal thing, at least in this culture.
Well, this, you know, these are such great points, Paul, and thanks for bringing them up. I mean, this is a reason why recovery programs can be pretty awesome, depending on your experience. A lot of people who have some problem with drinking or some alcohol problem or are self-identified alcoholics grew up socialized around alcohol in one way or another. And then when they stop, it becomes incredibly difficult or awkward to keep maintaining in social interactions, or they might not even have the skill sets or know how to do so. And so in recovery programs, there's a built-in community that not only helps you go through a process to figure out what's going on, but gives you a community of people that it's safe to be around. I can speak from experience and say that just re-socializing after stopping drinking and having people knowing that I was not drinking became difficult because of how frequently alcohol is around. It's a temptation if that's something you're not trying to do. It can be, when the expectation is for everyone to get a little buzzed, it's really annoying to be around buzzed people when you're not drinking.
I've heard that.
People think they're much funnier and smarter, and they're actually a little bit dumber, and you have to deal with that. The other piece is, my wife and I were talking about this morning. I stopped drinking, and maybe two of my friends that I've had over the course of years really engaged me about it. And sort of, I heard supportive messages from a broad reach of people. But I think a lot of my friends who were drinking as sort of a part of their life, they didn't know how to deal with me not drinking. And so it was just sort of never an issue. We never even talked about it, even though it was sort of a big thing that I was going through. I think in our society, as it's constructed right now, where drinking alcohol is not only a norm, it's sort of glamorized. It can be very difficult, speaking to Paul's experience, to be the outlier. It can feel alienating and strange.
Paul, thanks for calling. We're going to move to Old Orchard Beach. And Melissa, hi, Melissa, go ahead.
Hi. Well, I'm curious about where you draw the line with medicinal use of alcohol. It isn't used medicinally, but a lot of people use it that way, and it has been in the past. And if anybody has a comment on that.
Dr. Koob.
Well, I mean, obviously, it's alcohol is not approved by the FDA for any medical use, but people do. The caller is absolutely correct. It's used medicinally. Alcohol is, believe it or not, a very powerful analgesic. That means it reduces pain, and so it's not unusual for individuals to use alcohol, especially in the evening when maybe arthritis kicks in and some dysphoria kicks in, to use it as in a form of self-medication. The problem is that it wears off. Again, it's the same issue as using it to induce sleep. And so, you know, a little bit is not going to hurt you, might have make the evening a little more enjoyable, may make the meal a little more enjoyable, make the socializing a little more enjoyable. But if you push that and you don't understand that, you know, it's not a linear dose effect function. It just doesn't keep getting better, as Alex pointed out. Tolerance develops, and it develops very rapidly to alcohol's beneficial effects in that regard. So I think, you know, many people use alcohol that way. If they begin to use it to self-regulate negative emotional states, you start crossing the line into a problem area. If you're using it just for enjoying an evening, as far as I'm concerned, there's no major harm in that.
Melissa, thanks for your call. Moving on to Rockland and Matt. Hi, Matt. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, it seems like different kinds of alcohol have such a widely different effect on you. Rum has one effect, vodka another, coffee, brandy. And I was wondering why it doesn't seem to be more universal. Seems like the same, basically the same drug, you know.
Dr. Koob.
Yeah, that's. I'm sorry, I was just going to say that's a great question.
But it's mostly pharmacokinetics, and that's a big word to mean how fast it gets to your brain. And when you're drinking, a distilled beverage, it's a higher concentration of alcohol, and if it's on an empty stomach, it's going to get to your brain pretty quickly. Beer is a lower concentration, and so it's going to take a while for that blood alcohol level to hit the peak. So So those are pharmacokinetic issues. On the other hand, if you're drinking to blackout, and unfortunately I have to say college students do this today, that means you're drinking so much that you have a blackout, and a blackout is where you don't remember things that transpired while you were intoxicated. A blackout is not unconsciousness. A blackout is simply you don't remember what happened, and everybody's laughing at you the next day because you did something rather unseemly, but you don't even remember it. So drinking to blackout can be done with any beverage. So it really depends on what you're describing and over what time course, and whether you're doing while you're eating or whether you're not doing it while when on an empty stomach, and what's in your mixed drink and what's not in your mixed drink. And even wines and beers have different concentrations now. Some of the craft beers have different concentrations than, say, a light beer. Look on the bottle of your Chardonnay and you'll see it's creeping up to the 14% level. So, it really depends on what you're drinking and what concentration is in the beverage.
Dr. Kube, I'm curious, when I wrote about my experience today to say, this is very specifically my experience. I'm not trying to talk about overall approaches, but I'm specifically going to try to re-pursue moderation. I wanted to be as careful about that as possible because I didn't want other people who have other specific problems to use my approach to justify, not pursuing treatment if they needed it. And I am hearing from a lot of people who I know are in recovery or part of recovery culture in one way or another, who are even reiterating that it's important to point out that some people, and these people self-identify as that, just can't drink. It is not an option. If they do, problems happen. To what degree is that the case of sort of all of these people who have a problem with alcohol in one way or another? Do we know how many just simply drinking is not an option versus people who can pursue other means, or is that still up in the air?
It's a very good point, a very good comment, and it's still up in the air. We advocate that if someone has a problem with drinking, whether it's a mild alcohol use disorder to the full blown what we discussed earlier, alcoholism type phenotype, that we recommend simply that the best solution is to aim for abstinence. That's our recommendation at the Institute. But we also recognize that there are vast individual differences, as you point out, and that everybody is different and everybody can work at it to a different level. And but what we don't know at this point, and that's where research is headed, is what predicts who can go back to, say, social moderate drinking and who cannot. Clearly, someone with 3 or 4 or 5 DUIs, I don't want them driving on Highway 5. I lived in California for a long time. I don't want them driving on Highway 5 in the wrong direction, or the Beltway here in Washington in the wrong direction. I think that you'll find that those individuals with severe alcohol use disorder just simply cannot go back to moderate drinking. On the other hand, a teenager that gets in trouble, when their frontal cortex is not quite mature in a college setting, and then matures and has a family and then returns to some moderate drinking, probably not an unusual phenomenon.
We just have a couple minutes left. Dr. Kube, I want to give you a chance to have some parting thoughts. What do you hope that how people think about alcohol differently that we may not have been thinking about it before?
Well, I think it's all in moderation is basically the main message to get across to Americans. But learn what is moderation. I think that's the key issue, and I think young people really need to understand that the patterns they start to develop as young people are the ones they're going to live with later in life. And what we do know is if you start drinking at 10 or 12 years old, and believe it or not, people do start excessively drinking at 10 and 12 years old, that sets your brain up for lots of problems as an adult, including a 4-fold, 5-fold higher likelihood of an alcohol use disorder later in life. So, there is a biological reason why the drinking age is 21. And the biological reason is your frontal cortex, the part of your brain that makes executive decisions, doesn't fully develop until about mid-20s. So you don't want to wreck that development. And, if I have a message for young people in America, it is don't wreck the development of your frontal cortex. Any of you that have raised a teenager know what I'm talking about.
I have two. Dr. George Koob, thank you so much for joining us today. Dr. George Koob is director of the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcoholism. Alex Steed, thank you to you as well. Founding partner at the content firm Knack Factory. He blogs about politics and culture for the Bangor Daily News and has had a series of thoughtful and open blogs about his experience with quitting drinking for more than a year and then slowly drinking a little bit again. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to the archives at mainecalling.net. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.